Welcome to Bridging the Gap. We are Alaskans discussing issues that divide us in order to find solutions that will unite us. Welcome to Bridging the Gap. Today is the 29th in a series of panel discussions of Alaskans examining issues that divide us politically in these turbulent times. My name is Paul Thomas. I live in Trapper Creek. The objective of the panel discussion is to derive through questions posed to the participants an understanding of the causes that have resulted in the current polarization of American political discourse. Subsequent to achieving a satisfactory understanding of the causes, it is hoped that through further discussion, a strategy for positive interaction can be constructed, which can achieve a respectful accommodation of each side towards the other. Today, we are going to be talking about economic justice and workplace justice. With us, we have Dimitri Shane, Panthea Redwood, and Dorothy Dunn. First question, folks. Are there any circumstances you see which would make you believe that a person deserves to live in poverty, where being poor is his or her own fault? Are there any circumstances where you think they should deserve to be in poverty?
Well, I'll take that one. I think it's yes. There are certain circumstances. For example, when I go to Hawaii and I see folks just living on the beach, and I can at times make that mental leap and say, hey, you know, if I decided to be in poverty and have nothing, I would move to Hawaii and just live on the beach in a tent. So, yeah, there is an abstract, there's kind of theoretical situation where someone can deserve to live in poverty when they decide to not participate in society and just be poor. So it is possible.
Make the decision not to work.
Yeah, not to work, not to own anything, and simply not participate in the industry or the economy, etc. So yeah, it's possible.
Okay. Panthea, what do you think about that?
I think in an ideal world, it might be possible, but I think you're making assumptions about the freedom of choice. I don't think everybody has the same ability to make choices that other people do. I, too, can look at the beach bum on the beach and say, he's young, he's surfing, he's having a great time. But to me, that's a different level or kind of poverty than someone who's forced there by background.
Okay, well, the question was, is there any circumstances where they do deserve, and you're pointing
deserve.
To a circumstance where they don't deserve?
Well, no, I don't like the word deserve. I think that's slanting the – I think it's possible that people could choose to live not high on the economic scale, put it that way.
Okay.
That's different
choice.
Than deserving.
Okay. That's a good word to be making the delineation with, deserve. Okay. What do you think?
I think the very question brings out outliers and exceptions to the rule. Is a person who's living on the beach in Hawaii fitting really what our definition of poverty might be? If that person has enough to eat, they have a warm place to sleep, they're in good health, is that poverty? Or is poverty a condition of suffering where people are having to do without enough food or without safety or without a roof over their head that keeps them away from the elements? So yes, it is possible to opt out of society, but I think most people who are very, very rare exceptions to the general population of the world who opt out are people who have found a way to meet their basic needs.
Okay, but isn't that basically what we have established as criteria as to whether someone qualifies for benefits, whether they have the ability or willingness to go and work and therefore do not deserve to have welfare benefits according to government regulations, not according to us. But isn't that really what they have been using in order to decide whether a person should get benefits?
That's a very different question than whether
I'm asking lots of questions. There could be lots of different questions here today.
True, but you need to be sure that we're answering the question that's being asked. So you shifted now to...
I'll ask the question. You make sure you answer the question being asked.
Well, you shifted now to the topic of benefits.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Whether someone should get benefits.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a different question than whether they deserve to be poor.
Sure. Absolutely. That's the criteria.
So now it's a question of whether people... For what the criteria are for benefits? I'm not sure of your question.
The question is, isn't that what the government uses to decide whether a person does or does not get benefits?
Can I jump in here?
Absolutely.
So just as an anecdote, I was running one of the community colleges in a small community in Alaska. At the time in the 1990s when the system was changed to temporary aid for needy families, what we call TANF. And prior to that time, it was possible for a single mother who had several young children and who had been trying to make ends meet to go to school, to college, in order to try to upgrade her skills in order to qualify for a working benefit that would allow her to provide for her family.
A job?
A job.
Okay.
However, the rules were changed in such a way that everyone who supposedly had the ability to work would then be able to go to work and not qualify for benefits. The rules were changed midstream.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What I saw happening was that quite a number of young single mothers who were working very, very hard to provide for their families had to quit school because they could no longer qualify for benefits. The jobs that they could get were minimum wage, very often jobs that did not provide a stable schedule so that you could work and go to school because you had to be available, what they call just-in-time scheduling. And they were forced then to remain in poverty because they could not go to school. They had to go and take whatever job was possibly available to them.
So the decision was made based on the mandate that everybody has to work to put them in a situation that wasn't going to be a long-term help to not only themselves but their families and society, because the government had this hardcore belief that you have to work, you have to work, you have to work.
It was a very short-sighted policy because many of the women who were single with mothers, of which I was one, were in school. And it was only by being in school that we could get a job that would take us out of the level of being able to provide for, I had three children, to provide for our children. Because if you get a job at a grocery store, that's minimum wage is not livable wage. So you have to go to school. You have to get training. You have to get educated if you're going to get out of that level. So I think the government wanted to be doing right, wanted to have people working, but didn't look to see what kind of work were they requiring.
Yeah. Dimitri, you have any?
Yeah, I wish we would have this discussion. We need like a hardcore conservative who would like take the opposing view of this situation, because the divide in this country, and I'm not that person, but but I can speak a little bit to it. The divide in this country is actually the notion, the idea that, you know, people that who are in poverty are kind of like this. The conservative view is that they are this beach bump kind of scenario, to where folks just kind of casually decide not to work hard. And then everybody in this room seems like believes this, that you get forced into it through economic circumstances and so forth.
Government regulations.
Or lack of, and just social circumstances and injustice and so forth. So, and that's really the divide in this country, and a lot of the policies that affect poverty are being enforced or brought to bear or brought to form in this from this view that that we just have a lot of beach bums out there that need to work harder, and it's not really, like folks have said, there isn't a long-term view.
They really were viewed as beach bums. Unfortunately, there's a racial
Component
of this also.
Yes.
Okay, is now this is another question, Panthea. So we're
I'm gonna just keep my questions straight.
Get it right.
Is a willingness to work a job, any job, sufficient criterion for an American to be allowed to be above the level of poverty? Is that willingness criterion enough that that person should be above the level of poverty?
Well, you know, I, as a young man growing up in Anchorage, I was a busser, and I remember this old waiter, his name was Julius, this old black waiter, and he had missing teeth and everything, but he was a really sharp guy, and I liked everything he said. And I was and he was a waiter, and he always got really good tips, and so I looked up to him. And I was running past him, and I said, you know, had a tub full of stuff, and I said, you know, Julius, I'm working hard. And Julius was sitting there folding napkins. I said, Dimitri, you know, don't work hard, work smart. and that stuck with me, and that's what you kind of have to do in the United States. You can't just say, I'm going to get into whatever job, and I'm just going to work as many hours as I can, because in the current environment, that could make you poor. And I think, you know, you can work three jobs at McDonald's or Burger King and it's not going to be able to pay the bills.
Oh, there's no doubt that people work and are poor.
Yeah.
But my question has to do with, should that be enough for them to be, in a sense of justice,
so should
above
somebody be
the poverty level?
So should somebody be able to work in McDonald's and be
still live above poverty level?
Yeah, and I think the answer is yes. It's just a question of how do we get there? Because if, you know,
another question.
Okay, all right, sorry. All right,
I'll agree with that question. So do they deserve, Panthea,
to be above poverty if they're willing to work?
Yes, absolutely. I don't think there's any question. No one in their right mind wants to be in poverty unless, as said, that the a person who is on the beach and has food and shelter, that person is chosen. But the people who are in a city who deserve, yes, they deserve more than
there
the poverty
go.
Level.
She got, mm-hmm. You came along to my word.
there's actually been a long-term movement called the living wage movement.
Right.
You know, which proposes that anyone who is working full-time, is diligent, is responsible, deserves to be paid enough money to live at least at a minimal decent level for the work that they do.
So we are all in favor of that. I count myself among you. Okay, in August 2018, the average rent in Anchorage for a 1 to 2 bedroom apartment was $1,047 a month. Minimum wage was recently raised 5 cents to $9.80 an hour. A 40-hour work week produces a month of gross pay, this isn't take-home, gross, of $1,500. Not counting payroll deductions, simple subtractions gives us a difference of $521 a month for food, transportation, medical care, all the other things that are required, insurance. Is that enough for a single income household or family to stay legally out of red ink? And what can they do to stay legal? So you're making your minimum wage job. You're working 40 hours, minimum wage job.
What's happened is that more people have gone into the workforce. You see more and more women going into the workforce. Percentages are way more now than in the 40s. You see younger people deferring education. You see people living with their parents. A lot of young people now have to live with their parents. They're trying to do anything they can.
So you're citing a bunch of examples there of ways in which people have managed to stay legal.
Correct. Yeah. But yes, there's a very great pull to not be legal.
Okay. Well, when you only have $500 left in a month.
It isn't enough.
It isn't enough. What can they do, Dimitri?
Well, I mean, many people choose to get a second job and keep working and working and deferring costs and not get health care, and, you know, and that's where, you know, it kind of snowballs on folks and they just end
up. I just had a student that told me that she just never got health care. She pays the Obama fine, but she doesn't, she just can't afford to go through with it.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's the issue, that your minimum wage job does not pay all the bills that you have, and it's not enough to start a family or raise a family on. And the question is, how do we fix that?
Part of the problem is it comes back to bite us in the butt, because as people get older, they haven't gotten the health care, so they don't have the level of health that they need to have. So then what they do is they have to go to the emergency room. So now, instead of paying the wage that would now enable them to get health care, they go to the hospital emergency room, and that's where
where it gets expensive.
Yeah, and that's because we don't pay them enough money to keep their health when they're young. We end up paying for it anyway. We just do it when they get old by using an emergency room.
That's true. And it's not just health care, but it's other things as well. Many people who are working full time qualify for food stamps, for example, even though those rules are changing and they qualify for less. But the cost is being passed from corporate America to public America in the form of benefits that we are required to pay for people who are working but not able to live on what they're working.
I'm not seeing how the corporate America to public America, how does that exchange occur?
If a person is not making enough to live on what they make working at minimum wage, then they often qualify for public benefits.
Like Walmart workers.
Whether it's at the emergency room because they can't afford to go to a regular doctor, or the food bank, or food stamps, or a variety of other resources that have been made available to people to help them to fill the gaps between what they need to have as human beings and what they are able to get with the resources that they earn.
So let me see if I'm getting what you're saying. You're saying that corporate America is getting a benefit by not paying these wages that public America has to basically subsidize in order to keep these people, you know, healthy workers that go to work every day.
That's right.
Okay, good point. All right, rich people have no obstacles to access to health care. Most Western nations have populations with comfortable access to health care. We're not one of them. Our middle class used to have pretty good access. These days, it's hard to say. I'm sure everyone here sitting has their own personal horror story about health care.
Let me stick up for rich people.
I didn't say bad things. I just said you had no obstacles to health care.
I'm saying there is obstacles. Like, I don't know what the heck my insurance policy is. Like, I don't know who my preferred provider is. I don't know what the deductible is, and on and on and on. So this system does set up obstacles even for rich people to access health care.
Okay.
I'll just put that
I stand corrected then. I should have said it's easier for
less
rich
obstacles.
There we go.
Let's not beat up the rich.
So no obstacles, less obstacles. Is health care a legitimate marker in determining whether our nation is economically just?
I think so.
Okay. We can.
I really do. And I think one of the things, I'm going to give my own private peeve as a
quite, that's what you're here for.
Quite
private
older,
peeves made public.
Quite older person. When John Glenn went back up into space at the age of 65, do you know what the result of that was? They changed the age at which people could qualify for Medicare, because the statement was, well, look, he can do it, so everybody should be able to not have to go on Medicare until they're 67 or 69 or 70, whereas it used to be the age was 65.
Well, they didn't. That might have been the argument, but I just got Medicare at 65, so.
How old are you?
60. So I'm going to be 66 here, and I just got on Medicare as I turned 65. My wife got Medicare at 65, too. 65 is the age for Medicare. Social Security, I think you can make adjustments.
Oh, maybe that's it,
yeah.
Social Security.
Yeah.
But one of them got changed. Social Security got changed such that you cannot get it at 65 if you were – there was a year, a birthday at which it got changed.
There was some kind of donut hole or something. I don't remember how that donut hole worked, but that was a big –
For Social Security?
Yeah, for Social Security. Do you know about the donut hole?
I'm about the same age as you, Paul. I'm going to turn 67 in December. And I was required to sign up for Medicare at age 65. And Social Security has a tiered set of benefits. So if you were born before a certain year, your retirement age, full retirement could be, I think you can retire as early as 62 and receive some benefits.
Yes.
Full retirement age now is considered 66. You can defer Social Security until
you're
70.
In another year, though, it will be 67.
Yes, it's increasing.
And then after
that, depending on when you were born.
Right, and after that, it will be moved to 69.
Yeah.
And the reason for the change for a lot of the people in Washington was John Glenn.
Yeah.
I don't want to blame John Glenn, but it's not his fault. It's not. But they see someone who's healthy, has had health benefits.
He's in space.
Any excuse you can come up with.
Right.
Okay, let's do a math problem. I have paper here for you.
Okay.
And I'm a math retired math professor.
So he gives us math.
So I'm going
to
give you a math problem. And here
I can't do math.
Okay. You're a student. The teacher says. You don't need a calculator.
Okay. I don't have a pen.
Okay. Now, our minimum wage worker that we talked about earlier, say he gets a tiny raise and now he earns an annual salary of $20,000 a year. This is what this guy earns, $20,000 a year. But his wife is a good gardener and canner, and he is a good hunter and fisher, so they manage to live on a budget of $15,000 in annual expenses. Okay, and therefore save $5,000 every year. At the end of their year, they have $5,000 they save.
Do they have children?
No.
Okay.
This is a couple.
Do they have medical expenses?
That's all taken care of. Listen, Panthea, it's my problem.
Don't be rewriting the problem here
just because you're mad at me. All right. And in the same town, there is a money manager whose annual salary is $300,000 a year. Okay. But the only skill his trophy wife has is buying expensive clothes and jewelry, accessories, cars, and vacations.
You sound like a communist, Paul.
Okay, all right. And their household expenses is $500,000 a year, thus leaving an annual deficit of $200,000. Okay. Which household has the higher happiness quotient? The $20,000 worker or the $300,000 worker?
Again, I'm going to modify your question.
Okay, the highest happiness quotient is what we're after here. Go ahead, do your modification.
How much health does the low-income person have?
Good health.
Good.
He's a hunter and fisher. His wife works on putting together really good meals based on their gardening.
Wonderful. Now, how much health does the $300,000 person have?
Great. I mean, she goes to the spa five times a week. He's always exercising, going golfing with his buddies. That's part of his expenses, too. That's why.
And this financial manager that's losing $200,000 per year and his wife, are they on cocaine or something? Like, why is this? What is happening? They have, like, expensive cocaine problem.
Okay, we could add cocaine to those household expenses.
If that'll
help you understand the problem
better.
What is
creating this deficit?
Yeah.
Well, once again, you're setting up a set of criteria that we don't have all the information for, because happiness is the term that needs to be defined.
Okay, define that for us,
please. What do we mean
by
happiness?
What do you think it means?
I think it means a sense of internal contentment with your life.
Not
whatever
shooting
that
and
means
hunting
to
a
that
poor deer.
Person, you know, so we don't have any way of knowing the answer to your question about how happy each of them is, because we don't know how contented they are with what they're doing.
Better question is the financial manager and his wife, are they in poverty because they're losing their $200,000 in debt.
Okay, are they?
I seriously doubt it, but not at the moment. They'll eventually probably be in poverty.
Okay, let's change it from happiness to, I anticipated this, to financial anxiety. Let's change that qualification to financial anxiety. Who has the higher, we won't call it a quotient, financial anxiety, the $20,000 a year couple or the $500,000 a year earning couple?
Well, I suspect that we have been led to believe it's the money manager who is more anxious than the people who are living within their means and actively providing for their own sustenance. And sounds like they're living a lifestyle that they prefer.
Okay. Everybody agree with that assessment?
You know, it's hard to say. People are weird creatures, you know. Like, what's his name? Manifold had a suit made from ostrich, and he was spending millions of dollars, and he was living in the red for decades, so... It just depends on how people are accustomed to living. Some people just don't care, you know. So these people might have a disconnect from money. They don't even know what they have or what they're spending. And they, you know, it just people are weird creatures at times.
I think that's a very good point. That it probably is that the $20,000 person or couple has more knowledge of their economic circumstances than actually even the financial manager.
They're playing it smarter is what you're saying.
Probably.
It's smarter. Like, what difference does it make?
Well, I'll also say they're obviously not living in a city also.
Yeah.
If they lived in New York City, they wouldn't be growing and canning and hunting.
They'd have to, right, they wouldn't be hunting and fishing. They could be fishing.
They could go upstate.
Yeah.
If they had the money.
Okay, NPR has been reporting over the past few years about most localities that snare poor people into court, finding convictions for misdemeanors, parking tickets, things like that, imposing fines that the guilty party does not pay in a timely manner, which results in not only late fees, but also additional charges, more convictions, more fines, piling up debts for court costs that are literally and figuratively insurmountable. They are caught in a vortex of increasing legal red ink that only a miraculous financial windfall could fix. Should we wait for the windfall miracle or consider other options to this court debt that these people find themselves in?
Who's we?
We society, we our nation.
Not the individual who's in debt, but we in general.
Should we work on changing that structure that would allow or prevent this from happening? Because a lot of times these are just decent people that have been caught up in some kind of minor mishap. I can call it a crime, but it's not necessarily a crime. A parking ticket, is that a crime?
Am I correct that involved in this is also the bail system?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
People who are poor more often have to make bail, and that just compounds the issue of the getting in debt.
And because they can't make bail, they can't go to work and therefore lose their job and have to get another job after they do finally get out. Yeah, bail's part of that, sure. So what could we do, or should we do anything to try to change that court fees for poor people system, or are we stuck with that?
Well, I think the issue is that there's a couple of things. If it's a systemic targeting of low-income people, then I think it's wrong. But there is a second element of it to where people just kind of have defeatist attitude and they kind of give up on it to where they get in some court fees, and you know, for the fees to get waived, they maybe just have to fill out a piece of paper and state their case, and they don't. And I've had numerous friends who are in these kinds of situations, and like, why did you miss the deadline? Why didn't you file this piece of paper? You know,
So what you're saying is your experience with your friends then have led you to be a little less sympathetic to...
It's not just that it's sympathetic, it's just reality. So what do? Do you just say, tell someone, well, because you're in a low-income bracket, we're just going to dispose of all the court rules and all the late fees and so on and so forth, you know.
You're saying that we shouldn't look to make changes there, or should we try to find something that's going to be...
My point is that, like, when we're talking about things like that, we're just nibbling around the edges. Ideally, the issue really in America and the way that we have, the reason that we have poverty that's increasing are for a couple of reasons. It's not even so much the living wage, although increasing the wage would benefit folks who are at the lower social economic bracket. But there are really two issues. I would say healthcare, the fact that folks can get healthcare at a decent cost in this nation. And the second issue is access to higher education and trade schools and so forth. So without those two things, poverty just increases. So until you address those two issues, fundamental issues in the society, everything else you're just nibbling around the edges. So
I agree with your assessment, but I think we could add housing to that.
But housing is a function of income and ability, to where healthcare is not. Is not a function of, even if you're making your living wage. If healthcare can wipe you out tomorrow and make you bankrupt, you know, and so until you have stable healthcare access, you can't attain housing.
Housing can wipe you out too, Dimitri. There's a lot of people that just after they pay their rent or pay their mortgage, there's just nothing left in that month.
That's true. But when you're talking about laying the foundation for solving the issue, I think you start with healthcare and education and move on to housing. I'm not saying housing should not be addressed, but I think healthcare and education are a good place to start.
I think he's correct in identifying these as issues, but I think it's even larger than that. I think it's an entire systemic issue that is all so interconnected and interwoven that we could not really unravel it by taking one specific issue. If we had universal health care for everybody, if we had a living wage for everybody, you know, all of those things would be very good and they would make a difference, but I don't think that they would resolve the issue of economic and workplace justice in this society. I think what we need to have really is a whole sea change in the way that human beings relate to one another.
Woo.
I think it goes very, very deep. And until we have a system...
I'll settle for universal health care.
Which is based not on a hierarchical schema of competitiveness where one person is pitted against another person to see who is going to win the game, but rather a system going way to the very bottom principle of the whole organizing of society where every person's concern is for the well-being of every other person. And all of our systems are based on that goal.
So universal application of the golden rule.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm afraid I'm still back at the I'd like to see universal health care. And I'd like to see access to education. I want to nibble at those corners because I think it's a long time. I don't think – how to put this? I don't think people are basically good or basically bad. I think everyone has the capacity for both.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, when you get into poverty – your capacity for doing poorly unto others increases.
For survival reasons.
So I don't want to wait. Well, I agree totally that the goal is definitely universal golden rule. I don't want to wait till that. I want to see us start, even if it's nibbling at the corners, I want to see universal health care. I want to see that worked on now.
We are bridging the gap with Dimitri Shane, Panthea Redwood, and Dorothy Dunn. We're talking about economic and workplace justice today. We're going to go on to another topic now, so be ready. Organized labor has a historic role in the discussion of this topic. Credit needs to be attributed to the labor movement for the 40-hour work week, overtime pay, minimum wage, and workplace safety. Do today's unions have any role in the notion of economic justice for every worker, or are they only concerned with workplace advantages to their own dues-paying members? So your opinion on unions in terms of whether they are helping us all workers, or is their concern limited just to their own dues-paying members?
Can they be concerned with all?
Are they?
Can they?
I don't know.
Is it even possible? In other words, can a union who is composed of all the workers in, say, the municipality of Anchorage, city workers, can they be concerned with the benefits going to a construction worker? I think it's outside of the purview of what they're set up for. If there was a universal union, then I'd say yes.
But I think by virtue of having unions, the wages and the work standards are kind of held up for everyone. So I think the answer is yes, they do help out. But with the unions now under attack and their own influence and power diminishing, they're less and less effective. So, I mean, that's kind of where we have ended up now with the Trump administration and this like slow dismantling of unions and union rights and our.
This has been going on for a while now.
Yeah. A long time.
The erosion has been.
And I think it's really too bad, because I think that what unions have done for the people whom they represent has been admirable. And I think the erosion of that, I mean, you see it even in attitudes, that the attacks on the unions have been so great that you see younger people feeling, oh, unions are useless, worthless. Why should we have them? But they don't go back and look at the history and see what did unions bring, what could unions bring now?
Mm-hmm. Well, unions have been given credit here, as I introduced this question, for the history of it. And the question was more is, that are they currently able to do more now?
I think that one of the issues that we've been alluding to regarding unions is, as they're under attack, there's a prevention going on that's much more effective than it was in the original movement of unionization, a prevention of people forming unions in the first place. So the unions that exist are still trying to support their dues-paying membership to some extent, but those who are not unionized are not able, for a variety of reasons, to form that collaboration amongst the group and thereby lift those who are not represented.
And also have to compete with workers who do belong to unions.
Yes.
For the work.
In some industries.
Mm-hmm.
And you also have this phenomenon that I think it's fair to say that if you look at a union members who pay dues, and you go to some of the unions around town, around the country, half of the people who work in the union shop, they actually don't dislike the union. So there is actually an issue where even the people who get a benefit from the unions don't necessarily fully appreciate the work that the union is doing for them. So that's kind of the phenomena that I have seen.
It's true.
What's your assessment of the role police unions play in the cases of officers involved in shooting unarmed black men? They have played a role, the police unions.
What role have they played?
They've supported the officers doing the shooting. Oftentimes, whenever those officers have been found through video surveillance with cell phone cameras, that they actually were guilty of a homicide.
But isn't that like saying people support their own?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, that whether they shot a black man or a white woman, I think that the union's is there to support and protect the people in it.
Yeah, I think that we kind of have to draw the line between what the union is doing and what the support has been received by fellow officers and so forth in the community. The union is there to enforce the contract and to make sure that the union paying member, the contract is abided by. So,
but a lot of times a spokesman is the head of the police union. Whenever they're talking about the protections that the officers must receive, the legal protections.
Due to the contract. I mean, the contract is there to protect everyone. So you can't just say, because of our moral opinion of what's going on here, you don't receive the benefit of the contract that we have all collectively bargained for and where I have been paying due. I've paid dues before, Paul, and if I paid my dues, I'd want the contract enforced regardless of what I'm...
I still do.
Hot water and...
Pay dues?
Yeah. I'm a member of a union.
I used to be a member of the union. I was president of a union until they kicked me out for asking how much...
They kicked you out for what reason, Paul?
They kicked me out because I asked how much dues we had paid from 1997 to the present, and they wouldn't give that to me, and so I was president. The adjunct.
Oh, okay.
Until they kicked me out. But that's another story. Of course, we are talking about unions now. So what's your assessment here of police unions?
I honestly don't have any expertise on police unions, and that's why I'm
not bringing forth
an opinion on something I don't know about.
Will Trump's tariffs help or hurt the American worker? Put on your economist hat now. We got tariffs coming up here. Well, what about your business? Do you do a lot of outside is your sales international?
For example, I fabricate some custom planter boxes in California, but the steel for those boxes comes from Korea. So these tariffs are creating a shortage of steel on West Coast, and you know you have projects and American jobs being lost because there's not enough raw material on the West Coast because a lot of our steel production is on the East Coast. You've just seen in the news that you know Ford is laying off 70,000 employees. I mean, I think that's all over the world, but you know you have oldest American auto manufacturer now probably on the verge of going out of business here pretty soon because all these components are global. They come from Canada, they come from China, they come from all over the world. So you start imposing tariffs and starting trade wars without thinking it through, you're going to hurt some American businesses in the process. I think Trump's idea is that on an overall will come out ahead, but it's going to be hard to tell that to Ford employees that, you know, don't worry about it, we're going to come out ahead. So I think there's definitely room for improvement in making trade more beneficial with China, for example, and addressing some of the inequalities that exist there between, as a U.S. manufacturer trying to export something to China versus, like, vice versa. But if you start... trade wars for the sake of starting trade wars, it's not going to work out well.
It's not working out well.
I think you have to look at the stock market and see the amazing collapse that's happened in the last several days. I mean, these
tariffs have been going on, or the threat of the tariffs have been going on for more than just a few days, though.
But the stock market recently has just tanked.
Uh-huh. And you attribute that to the tariff talk?
Well, that's what they can attribute it to, the uncertainty and worry about whether they're going to get the raw materials that they've been able to get in the past. And they see things like Ford cutting jobs.
Mm-hmm.
They don't see the profits that have been being made in the past.
Dorothy, tariffs hurt or help the American worker?
I think very good points have been made, and I think that we need better negotiators rather than the big man with a big stick.
This is Bridging the Gap on KVRF Big Cabbage Radio. We have Dimitri Shane, Panthea Redwood, and Dorothy Dunn talking about economic justice. One of the results of globalism is, and Dimitri, you alluded to this earlier, manufacturing, which is used to supply good-paying jobs for American workers, now uses foreign workers whose pay is a tiny fraction of what the American worker used to earn, or by robots who get no wages at all. You'd probably be able to address this directly based on your own experience and what's going on with your thing now. But are we going to see manufacturing jobs in America come back again? And do you consider this development unjust? the fact that we have more foreign manufacturing going on and more robot manufacturing going on, replacing the American worker?
You know, it's a hard question because it's not yes or no.
There are no easy questions.
That's right. In fact, before I got here, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine, and you know, we actually got on the subject of Trump tariffs and manufacturing, and it's like, well, what are we going to, you know, bring back the Frisbee factory? Like, what is the role of the American worker in the modern economy? Because even in China now, the Chinese workers are being replaced by robots. Mm-hmm. So we can't just blame it all on China. So we have to be willing to look at the whole problem. For example, I manufacture some of my goods in China, and it's only because I wasn't able to find a manufacturer here in America. It wasn't because I wanted a lower price, but I wanted to improve the quality and actually have someone consistently and reliably make my product, and I couldn't find that here after looking for 2 years.
You got it from China then?
I got it from China, and I was looking in Indiana and in Michigan and all these places where you say is the Rust Belt and people are looking for jobs and et cetera. I emailed hundreds of metal fabrication shops, and they just wouldn't take my projects. So that's the reality you have to look at. So either your manufacturing capacity doesn't exist anymore, we don't make retail goods, we simply do not make retail goods in this country any longer. That's just a reality. And that's because if you think about what goes in to making a product, it's one thing to make a product. It's another thing to package a product. Actually, to package a product actually takes longer than to make the product itself.
And you better package it well, you're not going to sell it.
But the packaging is a very low it's a very time consuming task that takes a very low wage worker to do. So, and you can't pay somebody here in this country to sit there and package something for $3 an hour. And that's the issue you run into, and that's part of the reason why we don't have retail fabrication here.
Are we done then? Do you believe that the manufacturing won't come back in America then?
It's just a question of what we should be making. We should be manufacturing higher-end goods. We should be manufacturing software and electric vehicles and solar panels and solar batteries. And like we are doing right now, like you look at Tesla and other people who are entering the new kind of economy that's emerging. So it's just a question of what we should be manufacturing, and that's why education and healthcare and so forth is very important.
I think the looking back to the mythical past of a manufacturing past, I mean, our last presidency was based on the fact that that somehow would come back again. But the reality, as Dimitri is saying, is just that it's not possible to go back there again. We're not Henry Ford and putting out...
We're putting out Teslas. We're better than Henry Ford. It's just we're not the same... We don't make Frisbees anymore, you know? And which is, you know, not the end of the world. We should be just doing something different.
It's just we can't bring the past back. So you need to be looking to something new.
You think that there is room for... manufacturing, if we make adjustments in the technological approach?
Sure, we can be making robots, which will destroy the Earth sooner or later.
I have a neighbor who's so worried about AI.
That's right.
What happens if they become self-aware?
That's right.
I think that the points that are being made are important. You asked about justice in mm-hmm. regard to this, and mm-hmm. I think it's not so much a matter of justice in this particular regard as a matter of economic evolution. It's a normal process for those kinds of manufacturing jobs to go overseas where workers are paid much less. It's a normal part of evolution for technology to continue to advance, and therefore fewer workers are needed to manufacture the same quantity of goods. And so the adjustments that are going to happen are going to have to take that into account. I don't think you can make laws and rules to say, oh, no, we can't let jobs go overseas. We can't use the technology that we've advanced to. It's not realistic.
So you're saying then that the evolution should include the justice component as to the economic
but not by benefits. Trying to prevent the
Do
evolution
we ever
from
define
taking place.
The meaning of economic justice.
That's what we're trying to do here.
Because like I don't.
You're
know,
welcome.
Like,
you're welcome to throw yours
I don't
in.
No, what is economic justice? You know what? You know it's because my measuring stick is like I grew up in Russia without. You know, running water and electricity, and I can't wake up here. That's my measuring stick. I'm doing pretty well. You know, I got electricity. I got a fridge full of food, and you know, things seems to be all right. So,
but economic justice for a single person isn't really the application of it globally for everybody.
Yeah,
but he's right. How do you define justice then?
Well, that was how that first question. Was framed,
I still think we should go
behind that first question.
Sorry.
Let's go back to that first question.
Well, I'd like to go to the idea of the evolution of economics. And because the lamplighters in London in the 1800s revolted because they had no lamps to light anymore. So it seems to me that we really need to be saying is that when we have this, we know this evolution is happening. We know that we can't go back to the old manufacturing jobs. What we should be aiming at is how do we make it right for the people who are losing their jobs? How do we give them the benefits that they, not to have them look back, but to have them, how do you give them the education to change into what they can and should be?
Have a plan for the transition.
Yes. That's economic
there
justice.
There are no more coal boom operators on the East Coast. I was thinking about that. You now have everything is electronic. You drive your car, and it automatically charges you a toll. And so there's a whole profession that's gone. So what happened to the toll booth operators? Is it unjust for them to all lose their jobs? I think that you're exactly right. There needs to be a plan for the well-being of those people who suddenly don't have a profession anymore. Not to say we can't have that technology advance, but what happens to these people? And that goes back to that whole sense of everybody's well-being. How do we provide for the well-being of people who are being displaced?
And since health is such a major issue, universal health care
feeds
right
in. And as is housing and comfort and food.
Right.
As well. Yeah.
Right.
So basically what we were getting at from the beginning, what I was trying to get at from the beginning, was an idea of what it would take in order to have that comfort level in terms of it being just. And I look at, you know, you don't have to be like a very wealthy person in order to be happy about the amount of money you have. But you can, and on the other side, you can be a happy person without a lot of money if there isn't somebody coming after you saying, hey, I want that money from you. You have enough. I remember growing up in the coal mining hills in Pennsylvania, western Pennsylvania, and people were just fine with very little money, but they had enough food to live and they had their house paid for. And a lot of that, I think, came from, you know, the fruits of the New Deal, the way that people were able to go into retirement and have Social Security and have that be enough to get to the grocery store. And I think extended families also had a lot to do with that happiness quotient that I was talking about earlier. Okay.
I think pride and dignity, too.
You're segueing into my next question. Let me go to it. Human dignity, self-esteem, embarrassment about being poor are issues that belong in this conversation. When I was growing up, they were called reliefers. Later, the term switched to welfare recipients. Regardless of the nomenclature, poor people are many times looked down on by other groups. Okay? Republicans have owned this condescending dynamic for decades so successfully that a big portion of their base are actual poor people who look down on others like reliefers and welfare recipients for not only being poor and lazy, but also being Black, Hispanic, gay, Arab, you know, the other things that we...
Immigrants.
Yeah, immigrants, right. How did this split of working class attitudes come about?
Propaganda.
Okay.
I think that there's been a very successful movement in terms of how issues, the framing of the issues... If you can look down on somebody else, then your own poverty doesn't matter that much. So if you can have someone who has less than you do, even though you have basically nothing, then you're okay.
You're at least better than them.
Exactly.
And if you can do that and you are part of the upper class, then you can keep people on the lowered rungs fighting against each other instead of fighting against you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think it's true that part of human nature is that you do feel better about yourself if you have something that someone doesn't have. For example, when we talk about healthcare to folks, and even though they have healthcare that doesn't provide great coverage and costs a lot, when you start talking about single payer or universal healthcare, the first words out of their mouth is like, well, I don't want my neighbor who is not working to have it.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, that's part of human nature. And I think some folks on the right have been able to exploit those divisions. But again, like I said, poverty is still relative. I don't say poverty doesn't exist in this country, but if you were to get me off the plane when I was 12 years old and take me to your worst apartment in Mountain View, I would have walked in there and I would have said, you have two TVs, you have Pepsi in your fridge. you're amazingly wealthy, Busby.
That's should have come to my house.
Yeah.
Where you would not have had running water, electricity, Pepsi, television.
So
you wouldn't have had anything.
But you were probably gardening and enjoying things that you probably that are better for you than television or Pepsi, right?
A better lifestyle anyway, right?
Actually, better best lifestyle. Compromise.
No, thank you.
Dorothy, you have the last word.
I have the last word?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I will then use my last word to respectfully disagree with what Dimitri said. I do not think that's human nature. Mm. I think that is learned attitudes. I don't think human beings have to make themselves feel better by looking down at somebody else.
Okay, that is all for today. I want to thank Dimitri, Panthea, and Dorothy for a great discussion, and all you listeners out there in Radio Land, bye. Thanks for listening to Bridging the Gap. We welcome diversified perspectives. If you are interested in becoming a panelist for a future show, send us an email to manager@radiofreepalmer.org.
This program is a production of Radio Free Palmer, recorded at our studios in Palmer, Alaska. The views and opinions of moderators and guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, the station, or its underwriters.